A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants us to untangle three creatures that everyone uses interchangeably, but that actually come from completely different worlds. The imp, the goblin, and the gremlin. And he's right. I catch myself doing this too. You stub your toe on a chair leg and suddenly it's a gremlin, a goblin, an imp. Whatever small malicious thing you blame for the chaos.
That's exactly the problem. Those three words aren't synonyms. They never were. An imp is not a goblin is not a gremlin, and a gremlin is absolutely not an imp. They have different origin stories, different moral alignments, different jobs. Conflating them is like calling a dolphin a shark because they both swim.
Here's why this matters right now. Gremlins have been creeping back into pop culture. There was that animated Mogwai series a couple years back, and goblins have basically taken over TikTok through this whole goblin mode aesthetic. Oxford made it their word of the year in 2022. So the lines are blurrier than they've ever been, and most people don't even know there are lines.
Which is genuinely a loss. Because each of these creatures tells us something specific about the culture that invented it. They're not just fantasy set dressing. They're fears given shape.
We're going to do what Daniel asked. Trace each one back to its roots, lay out what makes them distinct, and then talk about why the distinctions actually matter. Especially if you're a writer or a world builder who doesn't want to just grab the nearest small creature label off the shelf.
I'll say this up front, the etymology alone is wild. The word imp comes from Old English impa, meaning a young shoot or graft, like a plant cutting. It had nothing to do with demons originally, it was a term for a child or a sapling.
Which is almost endearing until you get to the part where it became the name for a witch's familiar.
That shift happens around the 16th century, when imp starts appearing in witch trial records to describe a small demonic servant that a witch keeps in a bottle or a ring and feeds with drops of blood. That's a long way from a sapling.
The imp goes from gardening metaphor to blood-drinking household spy. Quite the career arc.
Meanwhile, the goblin comes from completely different soil. Old French gobelin, which traces back to a specific demon, Gobelinus, recorded haunting the region of Evreux in France in the 12th century. This wasn't a household spirit. This was a territorial entity that plagued a whole region.
Already, just from the words themselves, you can see the difference. An imp is attached to a witch, to a household, to a specific person. A goblin is attached to a place. It's not yours. You're in its territory.
The gremlin is the baby of the group. It's a 20th century invention. First documented in RAF pilot slang in the 1920s, first appears in print in 1929 in a journal called Aeroplane, pilots blaming unexplained mechanical failures on small malevolent creatures that live in the engines.
Which is such a perfect detail. You're in a metal tube thousands of feet above the ground. Something starts rattling that shouldn't rattle, and your brain reaches for a story. It's not superstition in the ancient sense. It's a coping mechanism.
It gets codified by Roald Dahl, of all people. He was an RAF pilot himself, and in 1943 he publishes a book called The Gremlins, the first time these creatures get a proper narrative treatment. They're small, furry, they sabotage aircraft for sport. The book was actually going to be adapted into a Disney film that never got made, but it laid the groundwork for everything that came after, including the 1984 movie, which completely changed what gremlins are. But we'll get to that.
The point for now is, three different centuries, three different languages, three different functions. The imp is a servant. The goblin is an antagonist. The gremlin is an environmental hazard.
Modern fantasy has just mashed them all into one bin labeled small fey creature. Mildly annoying. Dungeons & Dragons, World of Warcraft. They treat these as basically palette swaps. Pick your color, pick your stats, they all do roughly the same thing. Which erases centuries of folklore nuance. And I'm not being precious. There's a real loss here for storytellers. If you don't know what makes an imp, you end up writing a goblin and calling it an imp, and the whole narrative logic gets mushy.
Let's actually do the work. We'll go one by one. Origin, behavior, moral alignment, and then talk about what happens when you get them right, and what happens when you don't.
Before we dive into the imp specifically, I want to name the framework we're using. The confusion isn't random, it follows a pattern. All three are small, humanoid, supernatural, or quasi-supernatural. That surface similarity is what lets the conflation happen. But once you look at what each creature actually does, its function, they fall apart completely.
It's like calling a butler, a burglar, and a house fire all things that affect your home. Technically true, completely useless.
That's the analogy. The imp serves, the goblin competes, the gremlin breaks. Three fundamentally different relationships to humans coming from three different kinds of cultural anxiety.
The RPGification of fantasy has flattened that entirely. When Dungeons & Dragons needs a low-level enemy, they grab whatever small creature label is handy and slap stats on it. The imp becomes a minor demon, the goblin becomes cannon fodder, the gremlin becomes... Honestly, most games don't even know what to do with gremlins.
Which is telling. The gremlin resists the flattening because it doesn't fit the medieval fantasy template at all. It's industrial. It belongs in a hangar, not a dungeon.
The roadmap is straightforward. We trace each creature's origin, compare them across three axes, origin, morality, and function, and then land on what each one reveals about the people who invented it. Because a creature that haunts your kitchen is not the same fear as a creature that haunts your airplane engine.
The stakes aren't just pedantic. If you're a writer, picking the wrong creature changes the logic of your story. An imp can be reasoned with, it has no inherent malice, it's just doing a job. A goblin can be negotiated with but never trusted, it has its own agenda. A gremlin can't be reasoned with at all, it's not a character, it's a force. That choice ripples through everything.
Let's start with the one that's been around the longest, and probably the most misused.
Old English impa, originally a young shoot, a graft, a sapling, a botanical term. By the 14th century, it meant a child, a young offspring. By the 1600s, it had become the name for a witch's familiar. Plant cutting, to child, to demonic servant.
The through line is something small that's attached to something larger. A graft on a tree, a child to a parent, a familiar to a witch. The imp was never independent. That's the key.
That's what makes Shakespeare's Puck the textbook imp, even though he's never called one directly. A Midsummer Night's Dream, 1595 or 1596. Puck is Oberon's servant. He causes chaos, turns Bottom's head into a donkey's, makes the lovers chase each other through the forest. But he's not doing it for his own reasons. He's executing Oberon's orders. He's the merry wanderer of the night, but he's on the clock.
He's a contractor with zero personal stake in the outcome. And that's the imp's moral alignment, amoral, not immoral. An imp doesn't hate you. It might trip you down the stairs, but only because someone told it to, or because it was bored. It's not personal.
Which is why imps show up in witch trial records as small demons kept in bottles or rings, fed on drops of blood. The Witch of Edmonton case in 1621, the Lancashire witch trials of 1612 imps appear. Imps appear as tiny domestic servants with names like Vinegar Tom and Sack and Sugar. They're pets with sinister job descriptions.
The domain is always the household or the immediate vicinity of the witch. An imp doesn't roam the forest looking for travelers to torment. It's in the kitchen, under the bed, in the walls. The fear represents as domestic, the idea that something unseen is interfering with your home.
That's the imp. Servant, amoral, household bound. Now the goblin is a completely different animal.
It's older in the written record. That 12th century reference to Gobelinus, haunting Evreux. That's our first solid attestation. But the goblin tradition in British folklore crystallizes in the late medieval period and runs strong through the 17th and 18th centuries. Goblins are territorial. They live in tribes, they hoard, they have their own society. They're not attached to humans at all. Humans are intruders in goblin space.
Unlike the imp, a goblin has malice. It wants to harm you. It steals children, sours milk, leads travelers into bogs. These aren't pranks. These are hostile acts from a creature that sees you as a competitor.
The fascinating exception proves the rule. The hobgoblin, a specifically British subtype, could be helpful if you treated it well. You'd leave out milk or bread, and the hobgoblin would do chores while you slept. Robin Goodfellow, often conflated with Puck, is actually closer to a hobgoblin. But here's the catch. If you offended it, it turned vicious. The helpfulness was conditional, transactional. That's not the imp's neutrality. That's a negotiation with a fundamentally independent entity.
A goblin has its own agenda, its own territory, its own social structure. You can bargain with it, but you can never own it. An imp you can own. That's literally its function as a familiar. And the goblin's domain is the wilderness, the cave, the abandoned mine. It's not in your house unless it's invading. The fear it represents is the outsider, the hostile force at the edge of civilization. Very different anxiety from the imp's domestic sabotage.
Which brings us to the gremlin. And the gremlin is the odd one out in almost every way. It's not medieval, it's not folkloric in the traditional sense, and it doesn't care about you at all. It cares about your machinery.
1929, the journal Aeroplane. First time the word appears in print. RAF pilots had been using it as slang, blaming unexplained engine failures, instrument malfunctions, landing gear that wouldn't deploy, on gremlins. The creatures were said to live inside the aircraft and sabotage it for entertainment.
Which is such a modern fear. It's not something is haunting my house. It's not something is lurking in the woods. It's the machine I'm depending on to keep me alive might betray me for no reason. Industrial anxiety in a nutshell.
Roald Dahl codifies it. 1943, his book, The Gremlins. Small, furry creatures with horns, wearing little boots, obsessed with taking apart aircraft. They drill holes in the fuselage, tamper with fuel lines, jam the rudder. And they're not evil. They're mischievous in the way a fire is mischievous. They're a force. You can't negotiate with a gremlin. You can't bind it to your service. You just hope it doesn't notice your plane today.
That's the third domain. Three completely different habitats. Three completely different relationships to humans.
The mechanism of confusion is just the size. They're all small, humanoid, supernatural, or quasi-supernatural. But once you map them onto those three axes, origin, morality, function, they don't overlap at all. The imp is a neutral servant born from domestic anxiety. The goblin is a malicious antagonist born from territorial fear. The gremlin is an indifferent saboteur born from technological dependence.
If you're a storyteller and you grab the wrong one, your whole setup gets wobbly. If you write a creature that serves a witch, but also has its own tribal society in the forest, you've mashed imp and goblin into something that makes no sense. The audience might not know why it feels off, but it will.
The etymology alone should stop you. Impa, a graft, something attached. Goblin, a regional demon, something that owns the ground you're standing on. And the gremlin. A 20th century coinage from men who flew machines they didn't fully understand and needed a story for why the engine just coughed at 10,000 feet.
Three words, three centuries, three completely different jobs. And yet here we are in 2026 calling a glitchy toaster a gremlin and a messy roommate a goblin.
That's where the conflation stops being trivia and starts having real consequences. When Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual lumps imps, goblins, and gremlins all under fey, or tosses imps into the demon category and goblins into humanoids, it's not just a taxonomy problem, it flattens the narrative function of each creature. The game treats them as stat blocks with different challenge ratings, but the folklore treats them as different kinds of story entirely.
An imp in D&D is just a low-level devil that turns invisible and stings you, which misses the entire point. The imp's narrative function is servant who might betray its master if someone offers a better deal. That's not a combat encounter. That's a plot device.
A goblin in D&D is essentially cannon fodder. A one-hit point humanoid you kill in the first dungeon. But in folklore, goblins are territorial strategists. They don't just charge at you. They poison the well, rearrange the trail markers, wait until you're asleep. Fighting a goblin should feel like a land war, not a bar brawl.
The gremlin barely exists in most RPGs at all, because it doesn't fit the sword and sorcery template. You can't stab an engine failure.
Which brings us to the practical question. If you're writing a story, a novel, a screenplay, a campaign, how do you use these creatures correctly? You pick based on what kind of conflict you want. An imp gives you domestic intrigue. A goblin gives you a territorial threat. A gremlin gives you an environmental hazard.
Let's make that concrete. Say something is messing with the protagonist's life. If it's an imp, the protagonist can investigate who sent it. There's a witch somewhere, or a rival who bound the imp. The creature itself isn't the villain. It's evidence of a villain. You can bargain with it, trick it, or trace it back to its master.
If it's a goblin, the protagonist has a completely different problem. The goblin isn't anyone's servant. It's acting on its own behalf, for its own tribe's benefit. You can negotiate with it. Goblins understand deals, but you can never trust it, because its interests will never fully align with yours. The story becomes a diplomatic thriller, not a detective story.
If it's a gremlin, there's no negotiation at all. You can't talk to it, you can't trace it to anyone, you can't appeal to its better nature because it doesn't have one. It's not a character, it's a condition. The story becomes a survival problem. How do you keep the machine running long enough to land the plane? The gremlin is the storm, not the villain.
That's why getting the creature right matters. If you write a gremlin that can be reasoned with, you've undermined the entire point. The fear it represents, technological betrayal, only works if the creature is indifferent to you. A gremlin that cares about your feelings is just a furry mechanic.
Which is exactly what happened with the 1984 film Gremlins. I love that movie, but it completely rewired what people think a gremlin is. In the original Raff folklore and in Dahl's book, gremlins are mechanical saboteurs. They live in engines. They tamper with machinery. The film turned them into biological creatures that reproduce with water and turn evil if you feed them after midnight. That's a completely different monster.
The film's gremlins are closer to goblins, honestly. They're malicious, tribal, they have their own agenda. They just happen to be called gremlins because the name was available and spooky. The original gremlin doesn't multiply. It's just there in the machine forever like rust.
Even the most famous gremlin story in pop culture got the creature wrong. Which kind of proves our point.
There's a deeper cultural layer worth sitting with. Each creature reflects a specific anxiety of the society that produced it. The imp is domestic paranoia. The fear that your house isn't safe, that something invisible is interfering with your private life. That fear peaks during the witch trial era when neighbors are accusing neighbors and the home feels permeable to evil.
The goblin is xenophobia, frankly. The fear of the outsider, the tribe in the hills that wants what you have. Goblins are often coded in ways that map uncomfortably onto real-world stereotypes. Greedy, ugly, clannish, living in caves, hoarding gold. Tolkien caught some flack for this, and modern fantasy has had to grapple with how goblin depictions can slide into racial caricature.
It's a real problem. When you make a whole species inherently greedy and malicious, and then give them physical traits that map onto human ethnic stereotypes, you're not just building a fantasy world, you're reinforcing a framework for dehumanization. Some modern writers have pushed back by making goblins more culturally complex, but the baggage is baked into the archetype.
Pure industrial anxiety. It shows up in the 1920s, right when aviation is still terrifyingly new, right when the First World War has just demonstrated that machines can kill on an industrial scale. The gremlin is the fear that the technology we built to serve us might just stop serving us, for no reason, just because it can.
Which is a fear that's only gotten more relevant. We don't call them gremlins anymore, we call them bugs, glitches, zero days. But the anxiety is identical. Something in the system is working against you and you can't see it and you can't reason with it.
The gremlin is the most modern of the three, but it might also be the most durable, because our dependence on machines has only deepened since 1929.
Which brings us to goblin mode, Oxford Word of the Year, 2022. Definition: a type of behavior which is unapologetically self-indulgent, lazy, slovenly, or greedy, typically in a way that rejects social norms. It went viral because people felt seen. Here was a label for the pandemic-era collapse of personal standards. Staying in bed all day, eating garbage, ignoring emails.
I get why it landed, but from a folklore perspective, it's a complete misappropriation. Goblin mode describes someone who's checked out, passive, slovenly. That's not goblin behavior at all. A goblin isn't lazy. It's industrious in its own malevolent way. It's digging traps, organizing raids, managing its hoard. A goblin doesn't leave dishes in the sink. It steals the sink.
A true goblin mode would be more like, you wake up, sabotage a neighbor's cart, poison a well, renegotiate your territorial boundaries with the hobgoblin clan down the hill, and then count your silver. That's not self-indulgent laziness. That's active, organized malice.
What Oxford actually described is closer to a sloth mode, if we're being taxonomically honest. But the point stands. The term reveals what we wanted in 2022. Permission to be chaotic, to reject the pressure to be productive and presentable. We reach for goblin because goblins sound transgressive and feral. But we stripped out the actual malice and replaced it with messiness. It's a domesticated goblin. A goblin that just wants to wear sweatpants and eat chips.
Which is almost an imp if you think about it. The imp is the creature of domestic disorder. The imp hides your keys, sours your milk, makes your candle flicker. If Oxford wanted a word for chaotic domestic energy, imp mode was sitting right there.
Imp mode doesn't have the same ring, but you're right, it's more accurate. The imp is the creature of small domestic sabotage. The goblin is the creature of territorial warfare. And we've collapsed both into a vibe.
The conflation has consequences at every level. It messes up your D&D campaign, your screenplay, your Oxford Word of the Year, and it messes up your ability to actually see what these creatures were supposed to mean.
How do we actually use this? I think there are three practical takeaways. One for writers, one for readers and viewers, and one for anyone who enjoys thinking about how stories are built.
For writers, the rule is almost embarrassingly simple once you've done the homework. Use the imp for domestic mischief. Use the goblin for territorial threat. Use the gremlin for technological sabotage. If you need a creature that serves a villain, that's an imp. If you need a creature that is the villain, with its own society and agenda, that's a goblin. If you need a creature that isn't a character at all, but a condition your characters have to survive, that's a gremlin.
Mixing them up doesn't just confuse your audience. It weakens the internal logic of the world you're building. If your gremlin can be bargained with, you've lost the thing that makes gremlins frightening. If your imp has its own tribal kingdom, you've contradicted the thing that defines an imp. It's attached, not independent. The creature stops feeling real even within the fantasy, because its behavior doesn't match its nature.
For readers and viewers, the takeaway is almost a game. When a modern story throws a goblin at you, pause and ask, is this actually a goblin, or is it an imp with a bad reputation? Is it serving someone? Is it operating on its own? Is it even capable of being reasoned with? The answer usually reveals what the author actually intended, whether they knew it or not.
You can extend that to all three. Next time you're playing a fantasy game or watching a creature feature, classify the creature using the three axes we laid out. What's its origin? Household, wilderness, or machine? What's its moral alignment? Neutral servant, malicious antagonist, or indifferent force? What's its function? Plot device, villain, or environmental hazard? You'll start seeing the seams in the world building immediately. Some creatures slot neatly into one category. Others will be a mess of contradictions, and those are the ones where the writer didn't do the reading.
That classification habit sharpens your instincts as a consumer of stories. You stop accepting small monster as a category and start noticing what the monster is doing and why. It's the difference between watching a magic trick and knowing how the trick works, except knowing how it works makes it better, not worse.
Finally, let's look forward. Because the creatures we invent are never really about the past. They're about whatever we're anxious about right now. And we're in a moment where our relationship with technology is shifting faster than our language can keep up.
That's the open question that's been sitting with me this whole episode. The gremlin was invented in the 1920s to explain why engines fail. We're now in an era where AI makes decisions we can't audit, where software glitches can cascade through entire systems, where your smart home might lock you out because of a firmware update, and we don't have a creature for that yet.
We have bug and glitch, but those are technical terms. They don't have a face. The gremlin worked because it gave the malfunction a personality. Small, furry, actively hostile. It turned a mechanical failure into a story you could tell. What's the equivalent for a neural network that confidently gives you the wrong answer? And you have no idea why.
I've heard people half-jokingly call it a glitch gremlin or a bug imp, but neither has really stuck. And maybe that's because we haven't settled on what the fear actually is yet. The gremlin was born from the fear that the machine would break. The new fear is that the machine will work exactly as designed and still harm you, because the design is too complex for anyone to fully understand.
The next creature might not be a saboteur. It might be more like a trickster, something that gives you what you asked for but not what you meant. A wish granter with bad training data.
Which is terrifying in a completely different way. A gremlin you can at least blame. The engine failed because the gremlin got into the fuel line. But when an AI denies your loan or misdiagnoses your symptoms, there's no creature to curse at. There's just a probability distribution and a room full of engineers who can't explain the output either.
That's the final thought I want to land on. The creatures we invent tell us what we fear. Diem says, we fear our homes aren't safe. The goblin says, we fear the outsider who wants what we have. The gremlin says, we fear our own machines. What will the next creature say about us? What are we afraid of right now that we haven't given a name yet?
I suspect it'll be something about opacity. Not that the machine will break, but that the machine will do something and we'll never know why. That's a fear the gremlin can't cover. It needs its own creature.
When that creature shows up, in a novel, in a game, in pilot slang from some future profession we haven't invented yet, we'll know what it means, because we'll know how to read it.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In permafrost regions, frozen methane bubbles can resonate at specific acoustic frequencies when thawed, producing sounds in the range of 5 to 12 hertz, low enough to be felt as vibration rather than heard as pitch. During the High Medieval period, Boudinot's oral histories record a legend of singing ground in the high passes, which modern researchers now attribute to this phenomenon.
Singing ground. This has been my Weird Probs. If you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. You can also find us at myweirdprompts.com.
We're back next week. Until then, keep your imps in the kitchen, your goblins in the woods, and your gremlins out of the engine.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.